Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Peach State Pandemonium, a production brought to you by the GWH Radio Network, where we take you down memory lane for a look at professional wrestling the way it used to be, with conversations from those who paved the way. And now, the GWH Radio Network presents Peach State Pandemonium. Welcome, everybody, to Peach State Pandemonium. Rich Tate here, filling in for Mike Norris on Pandemonium here for a while, joined by my co-host Jerry Oates and Bobby Simmons. Guys, happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Did I have a nice one?
We had a great one. We went to Columbus, Georgia. We went to Jerry's old stomping grounds today and had a good trip, good day.
Well, good for you. Does it change much? Since you were there?
You know, in a lot of ways it has, in a lot of ways it hadn't. We go to my daughter's house. She actually lives in Midland, so we get off at County Line Road and go out back that way, so we don't actually get up into town. But it's last time I was downtown, man, it had changed so much. It was just, I couldn't find anything. I got lost going to Front Street.
I've only been there once since I moved, and it had changed since I left.
Oh, it's...
How was your Thanksgiving, Rich?
It was very good. Ate more than I should, but hey, don't we all?
Everybody.
Oh yeah. So one day a year we have an excuse.
Exactly.
We don't want to make anybody mad or offend anybody by not tasting everything. So.
Well, obviously we've had a couple weeks off and. Last Thursday, Bobby, you spent the night down at the Georgia Dome watching that game that got away, but haven't they all this season?
Yeah, well, it actually was a pretty good game. They played close enough that they made us stay till the end, so we couldn't even get out early. But we enjoyed it.
What time did you get home from there, Bobby?
About 20-1. The game went pretty quick. They both ran the ball a lot, so the clock ran pretty good. It wasn't a real long game, so it actually wasn't that bad.
Well, guys, I know you've done Thanksgiving shows before, but obviously, it's topical, so we're gonna go over it again. And I don't know how many of our listeners or if you guys got a chance to check out GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com's news section today, but we were throwing up the old cards dating back to 1975. When the tradition first started running with the consecutive cards at the Omni. Jerry, I know you worked a couple of those, and Bobby, I know you were around for many of them yourself. Can you guys just, off the top, talk a little bit about, what was different about a Thanksgiving event at the Omni as opposed to any other holiday? Or any card in general?
Well, Thanksgiving was always you were generally assured of a sellout because it just became the night everybody went to the wrestling match here in Atlanta. We were back in the day when I was there. We kept the box office open 9 to 9 every night leading up to the event, so we had people had plenty of access. We did not charge a service charge if you picked the tickets up from us at the arena, so we sold a lot of tickets out of that sports arena window. And it always seemed a little magical, if that's the right word. There was always a lot of electricity in the air, people anticipating that night. It was just always real good. I enjoyed them. I refereed several of them, and I was there for a lot of them, but... It was a fun time.
Yeah, thinking back to it and just looking back through some of the history and just recalling what I can remember of the time, it was sort of seemed like Thanksgiving would be used to at least blow off a couple of the big feuds that were going on and start to build some of the new ones for the next year. Kind of like the pay-per-views now.
Right. Well, they were like I say, you were guaranteed a big crowd, and the guys the guys always worked hard. So it was a fun time for me. That was the first time Atlanta ever busted $100,000 was on a Thanksgiving night. We actually grossed $103,000. And I don't remember what year it was, but that was the biggest house that had ever been drawn in Atlanta.
If I had to guess, I'd say, based on the card, probably 79, maybe 80 or 81.
Could have been in there. I'm not sure. I don't remember the exact date. But I do know, I mean, it was, you know, ticket prices were, I guess our top ticket price at that time was probably $8.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of, you can figure out and equate how many people we had there.
The configuration
of the Omni was about 18,000.
Right.
Roughly.
Jerry, you worked a couple of these cards that we posted up today, 76 and 81. What do you remember about working the Omni on Thanksgiving? Was it a little something special?
Yeah, it was always special, especially when you worked Columbus that afternoon. We always worked Columbus that afternoon and go to the Omni. In 76, Ted and I were in a tag. I think we were in a tag match that night. And then that was my last night in the territory, and I left there. I think I left there and went to, yeah, I did, and I went to Louisiana from there. So, yeah, I made several of them.
Yeah, on the night you're talking about, that was you guys putting over Ricky Steamboat and Dean Ho.
Yeah, I don't even remember who we wrestled, because I knew I was leaving. In 76?
Yep.
There was, no, I wasn't. Going to, I was going to Shreveport. That's where I was going. Yeah, that was my last night in the territory.
Of course, the cards, the first of the consecutive run got started in 75. Bobby, you'd been here about a year about that time. They hadn't run a Thanksgiving for many years before that. Do you remember why they decided to go ahead and give Thanksgiving a shot?
In 75, I wouldn't have had privy to it. I was still refereeing, and I was helping around the office, but I wasn't in the back office at that time. But I think they just finally figured out somebody finally came to the realization that on Thanksgiving, once the afternoon meal was over, and back in that time frame, you know, the stores were not open. You didn't have these like it is today where all these stores are opening on Thursday. There was nothing to do. It was either watch TV, go to a movie, and then, you know, there was only two football games that day. You always had the Lions game at lunchtime, and then you had the Cowboys at 4 o'clock. But when it went off, I mean, there was nothing left to do. And that was Barnett's philosophy, was let's give them something to do.
And it paid big dividends over the years.
Yeah, it turned out to be great.
Yeah.
That led to working Christmas night every year.
Now, the first year, my memory doesn't serve well on 1975. I was only 7 years old, but... Looking back at the card, headlined by a cage match between Abdullah the Butcher and the Sheik, that had to be a wild, woolly affair. Would that have been you refereeing that, or would that have been Charlie or Ron?
It would have been me and Ronnie West. I refereed several of them Sheik Abdullah things. Yeah, it was. You know, you were in the ring for 6, 7, 8 minutes, at the most 10 minutes, and then you spent 15 minutes fighting through the crowd.
Who is the crowd pulling for in that match? Abdullah?
You know, sort of. I mean, I think it was one of those things where they wanted to see them kill each other.
Yeah.
I don't really know that there was a definitive babyface in those matches. It was just they were kind of wanting to. It was just, I mean, and of course, with those two guys, you know, it was not a. It was not a great technical exhibition of wrestling.
No.
I mean, there was pencils, coat hangers, forks, you know, fire. I mean, you know, it was just, yeah, it was, they just wanted to, that was one of them situations where the guys that could work would go out and put all the time in, and you'd, that'd last 15 minutes at the most. And that was from coming out of the dressing room to fighting through the crowd to getting the police to get them back in the dressing room.
Yeah, and also that night, go ahead.
Was that the first time? I mean, I don't remember. Was that the first time those two guys wrestled each other in Atlanta?
You know, it could have been.
Was it a cage match, or was it?
It was a cage match.
It was a cage match. Well, then that wasn't the first time then. It was that way they had led up to that.
Yeah. I think there had been like a series of matches, but that was really the first run where the two of them were together. You know, the Sheik had wrestled here all the way back, 60, 61. But I don't think the two of them ever got in the ring together until that, you know, that fall.
Yeah.
The spoiler, they had a Georgia heavyweight title versus mask match. Now, you kind of had to know how that was going to come out, but obviously that's gonna put butts in seats, hoping to see the spoiler have to unmask. But obviously, you know, the heel walks out with the Georgia heavyweight title.
Yep. Who was he wrestling?
Moondog Bane was here.
Was he wrestling
Moondog Bane was in that card. Oh, go ahead.
Who was the spoiler wrestling? Two?
Oh, it was Mr. Wrestling Two. He beat him for the title.
Yeah, okay. Okay.
And then kind of an odd tag team match. Ernie Ladd and Bobo Brazil beat Harley Race and Ox Baker.
I refereed that one. I do remember that.
Jay Strongbow over Brute Bernard. Jerry Briscoe and Bob Backlund teamed up to beat Dick Slater and Bob Orton Jr. Tony Charles beat Ron Garvin, and in the opener, Luke Graham and Dean Ho went to a draw. In 76, that was Ole Anderson in Gene Anderson's first year as the Bookers. They came in as World Tag Team Champs and defended them against Mr. Wrestling 1 and 2, retained. The Sheik over the Mighty Igor by count out. Ox Baker and the Stomper over Bob Armstrong and Bill Watts. Thunderbolt Patterson beat Dick Slater in a Georgia heavyweight title match by count out. Slater retained. Jack Briscoe goes over Killer Brooks. Black Atlas being Tony Atlas under the mask, of course, over Bill Howard. Steamboat and Dean Ho over the Oates Brothers. Robert Fuller over Mr. X. Who would have been Mr. X on that card? Because there was a Mr. X working here that year pretty regularly under the hood, but I never found out who that was.
I have no clue.
So it wasn't like a one-time thing. It was a regular deal. I would have said Bill Howard, but Bill Howard was working without a mask, so I don't know.
I don't know who that would have been either.
Was Jim Dillon here managing the Stomper or anything? I mean, I can't remember if Dillon was here. Was Dillon here at that time?
Yeah, he was.
Now, Dillon worked a lot under a hood. He'd go out and work opening match or second match, and then he'd come back and manage, you know, Arch in the main event. But I don't know if that's who that was or not.
I'll check into that with him then. Let's see, Tony Parisi over El Gato and Raymond Rujo in the opener over Scott Irwin. Any of this stuff brings
back
memories, guys. Throw it out.
None of that stuff to me, none of it's triggering anything.
Yeah.
I do remember refereeing the Harley and the, against Ladd and Bobo. I do remember refereeing that one. I think my matches with Bobo kind of stick out in my mind. He was such a great guy that anytime you could work with him, it was a pleasure.
Let's see, 1977, the main event, Tony Atlas over Abdullah the Butcher. And at this point in time, Rock Hunter was managing Abdullah, Pak Song, and the Sheik, who came in and teamed with Pak Song, put over Ernie Ladd and Thunderbolt Patterson. Dick Slater and Mr. Wrestling 2 teamed up to beat Ole Anderson and Stan Hansen. Hansen was still kind of new to the area at the time. Bob Armstrong versus Rene Goulet. That ended in a no contest. Tommy Rich over David Schultz. Charlie Cook and Raymond Rougeau over the interns. Richard Blood. Of course, that would have been Tito Santana. Over Jim Grabmeier. Jerry Stubbs over Randy Savage in the opener.
And that was 77?
Yep.
Okay, I wasn't here. I was out that year. That was the year I wasn't here.
You were in Mobile, right?
I was in Mobile, yeah.
Let's see, 78 is the first year they did the tag team title. It had become vacant, and let's see, in the main event that year, Thunderbolt Patterson beat Ole Anderson, but in the finals of the tournament, Terry and Dory beat Jack and Jerry for the title. And some other teams that were in this tournament, Rick Martel and Tommy Rich, the Islanders, which of course later were the Samoans. The Assassin was teamed up with Masked Superstar, Bugsy McGraw and Rufus R. Jones, Pak Song and King Kong Maska. Haystacks Calhoun was in here. I think that was the last appearance by him. He was teamed up with Klondike Bill. Ernie Ladd teamed up with Stan Hansen. What can you guys tell me about Haystacks?
I was around him quite a bit. I was with him in Kansas City. I was around him in when I was over in Montgomery in the early 70s. I was around him in Detroit. And he was a nice man. Real nice man. He was, rode with him a lot. He was fun to be around. He knew all the eating spots. I was with him in Louisiana also.
Now, I never got to see him work. I've never seen any video or anything of him. I can't imagine him being a great worker, but, I mean, was he just basically more of an attraction?
Yeah, he was, but, I mean, he would, for a guy his size, you know, he would do what he was supposed to do. He didn't go out there and guzzle anybody. He would respond to whoever he was working with and never caused any trouble about what he was supposed to do or who he was with or anything like that. And of course, he made a lot of money early on in his career, I understand.
Yeah.
But then, you know, I don't know how long he would stay. I know in Louisiana he was there like maybe 3 weeks, maybe a month, you know, make all the towns. And I know when Ted and I we were just kids, we went to Charlotte for the summer. And he was up there, and I mean, they were really pushing him then up there, you know, with different things. I know he worked with Buddy Rogers for the world title in Charlotte outside. We went, there was a ballpark there they ran. I don't remember what it was. I was like 12 years old. Ted and I thought he was going to beat Buddy Rogers for the world title. He was so big. You know? That was a treat getting to see Rogers. But, yeah, he was fun to be around, and I know we were up in Detroit. It was in the wintertime, and Strongbow and I were going to catch a ride with him. We were outside waiting for him to open his vehicle, and Scarpa finally said, "Come on around, man, open this truck. We're about to freeze." He called him around, man. But, you know, they'd known each other, I guess, day one. You know, they were real good friends. And then one Sunday, I had stayed over from a Saturday night in Detroit, and we were booked up into Canada. And I rode with Stacks up there. We went up there for the Bear Man. So we're going down, we're up in Canada, and we're going through, we're crossing the border, and Stacks said, "Now just tell them we're tourists." I said, "All right, whatever." So they, you know, we had to stop, and he just told me we were tourists, and we went on, and we're going down this interstate, and it's cold up there. I mean, cloudy, and it's cold. He said, "Neighbor, would you like have some deep dish apple pie?" I said, "Yeah, why not?" He said, "I know where the best in the country is up here." So we're going down this interstate. He crosses the median and gets off, crosses over the other side of the interstate. We go in this place to get some deep dish apple pie, and he was right. It was the best I'd ever eaten. He knew where all the spots were. He was something.
I got a second what Jerry said. He was a super nice guy.
He was. He really was. You know, I felt sorry for him. You know, he traveled mostly by himself, and I know we were at we were at Atlanta TV, and I don't know why he needed a ride to Columbus, and nobody would take him. They didn't want, you know, he was so big, and I told Tom, I said, "I'll take him." I said, "I'll take him to Columbus." So he rode with me, you know. The guys kind of, you know, some shunned him, but
yeah, he was.
He was just
guy.
One of the boys to me, you know. He was one of the boys.
He was very, very funny, and he was a smart fella. I loved to talk to him.
And he was an immaculate person, you know, for somebody that big. All his ring gear was all, you know, he wore those overalls. They were always immaculate, and he was a good guy. I felt sorry for him because most of the time he traveled by himself. You know, he had his own. He used to drive Travelogues. It was made by International. It was like a big SUV back then, you know, and that's what he always had.
Him and his dog.
Him and his dog Jewel.
Yep.
And I know when he was in Kansas City, he said, "Where are we going to be the next night?" He called everybody neighbor. He said, "Neighbor, you want to ride with me tomorrow?" I said, "Sure, I'll ride with you." He had a little TV in there, even back then, in the mid-70s. He had a TV in there. He was just fun to be around. He's interesting to talk to. You know, he'd been everywhere and seen guys that, you know, I'd only heard about, you know. I don't know. When did he start, Rich?
Oh, God.
You have any idea?
I could begin to tell you. I wouldn't
Late
50s? I'm thinking the first time he was in here was maybe 60.
Because we went Charlotte up there in 62. It was probably the late 50s, 58, 59 maybe. I may be missing a year or two either way. But he was in all the magazines when I was a kid, you know.
Yep. He was a big fella, but what everybody remembered him for was that stupid horseshoe he wore.
That horseshoe.
He had a horseshoe on a chain he wore around his neck.
And always hanging on a ring post.
Yep.
Did you ever see him, Rich, in person?
Just pictures. Never saw him work. Never seen any video.
Is that right?
Yep.
Isn't that something? Yeah, he was something.
There is some video out there, and Michael Norris may have it, but there's some video out there of Stacks working in Detroit that I've seen.
Okay.
But Jerry hit the nail on the head. The thing that made Stacks, to me, different than the other big guys, most big guys, when they'd come in, you know, they wouldn't sell anything. They were too big to be hurt. But, you know, I don't care who you are, when a big guy hits you, another big guy hits you, you're going to react to it, and Stacks would sell.
And that's what I was trying to say earlier. He didn't come in as like I'm King Kong or nothing like that. I mean, he was smart enough to know the deal. But I heard his manager ripped him off early on. I forget his name. Do you remember that, Rich? You remember reading about his manager? Are you, Bobby?
No, I don't know about that one.
Yeah. I guess this guy was kind of booking him or handling him, you know, getting him bookings or something. But I tried to run him down. I forgot when he died. And I was still at the gym, and I knew he was in New Mexico. Tupamcari, New Mexico, is that how you say it? And he had lost both of his legs.
Yep, that's what I heard.
And he was in a nursing home, and I couldn't locate him. I called different guys trying to, you know, I just wanted to call him and talk to him, you know, and, but I couldn't run him down, and then he passed away. Where was he from, originally from?
I believe Texas. I know he was.
I think
he. I'm looking up some stuff on him now. It says he was born in Texas. Appears he was raised there. I was looking for the manager thing. I can't find anything on that. But it does say he started in 55.
55 earlier than I thought, then. Did it say when he died?
That was in December 1989.
89, okay.
Yep.
Yep. Well, yep, I tried to run him down.
It says they built him from Morgan's Corner in Arkansas. Yeah, he grew up just north of Dallas, Texas.
Is that right?
Yep.
I know he had a daughter. He used to talk about his daughter. Now, where she lived, I don't remember where he said. But he had a daughter.
All right. Before we start talking about some more cards here, we got lines filling up. Let's go to some phone lines and see what we got here, see who we got. Maybe some friends, maybe just some folks looking to get in here in the conversation. Maybe, hopefully, some people have been to some of these shows. It's 251 area code. You're on the line with us. Who we got? Apparently nobody. All right. 334 area code. I believe that's South Alabama. Who we got on the line with us? All right. And let's see, 770 area code. Somebody on the line here. Who is this?
It's Jay West here.
Hey, Jay. How you doing? Happy Thanksgiving.
I'm all right. I saw you guys on the Facebook. You were going to talk about the Omni tonight at the Thanksgiving, and I said, well, you know, I went to one or two of those. I could add something, but really enjoyed you talking about Haystacks there. I can remember him in the early 60s on the Live Atlanta Wrestling Show. And the term that he always used was, when he'd do his interview, was going to have a tussle. You know, he would tussle with the guys. That was the term he would use. And I'm sorry you never saw him work, because he was quite interesting. Certainly a lot different, I'm sure Bobby would say so, than watching, say, somebody like the McGuire twins. Big guy. He could handle himself, like Bobby said. He knew how to work the match, and he didn't mind going down at his knees. And that's when you would figure that if he was, you know, he was down, he was pretty well out. But he'd make the comeback, and he was a feature attraction. I remember Freddie telling me he would, when he would come in for a week or so, he'd work the city auditorium on the Friday night, and then Freddie'd take him on the road with him to some small towns. He would be, you know, folks in the small towns would really, you know, eat what he did up. So he did real well when he was here, I think.
You got any conversation you can help us with on any of the cards we've talked about up till now?
Well, you know, yeah, I was there for most of them, worked nearly all of them. The thing that I remember the most about Thanksgiving night at the Omni was the terrible traffic, you know, trying to get there and out. And one of the problems was that not only did you have that 18,000 folks trying to get into the Omni. But on Spring Street there, that was the night that Riches did the lighting of the big tree. So because of that, you had folks downtown for that, and it was just terrible traffic. Folks really enjoyed the cards, and that was the night you were going to have a packed show. And like Bobby said, 18,000 fans was the norm for Thanksgiving.
This ain't got nothing to do with wrestling. This ain't got nothing to do with wrestling, but since he said Riches, I just wanted to throw this in. This year, for the first time, the tree, they moved it to Lenox Square and put it on top of Macy's there. For the first time this year in the history of lighting that great tree in Atlanta, the tree is artificial.
Yeah.
Well,
they said last year taking it down, the tree broke and it took out a big corner of the building, and it cost them all kind of money to repair the building, and they couldn't take that chance anymore, so they have gone to an artificial tree.
Isn't that wonderful?
I mean, my childhood is just going away from me, and in more ways than one.
You can't hardly get past Halloween now until it's Christmas, you know. it's like now the advertisers want Halloween to go away, you know, because it's interfering with Christmas. It used to be Thanksgiving was when the Christmas stuff started, but not now. It's ridiculous.
That it is. All right, let's see. We left off at 78. Let's start 1979. That year, Lights Out match. Ole Anderson and Thunderbolt Patterson teamed up to beat Ernie Ladd and the mystery partner who turned out to be Ivan Koloff. In a loser leaves cage match, Tommy Rich beat Bobby Heenan. I want to talk about Bobby.
That was such a match.
I want to talk about that in just one second. Also, we had Mr. Wrestling 2 versus Mr. Wrestling 2 ending in a no contest. We'll talk about that in just a second. Ugh. And I'm sure to some people that looks like a typo. And then winning the, once again, conveniently vacant Georgia Tag Team title tournament. let's see, Austin Idol and the Masked Superstar. Man, that team was too short-lived. I would have loved to have seen those guys team up longer. They won the belts by going over the Briscoes in the final round. We'll run down some of the other names from that tournament here in a bit. Obviously, the Bobby Heenan match. You got some thoughts on that, Jay?
Well, I mean, it was, as Gordon would say, Heenan's face was a crimson mask. It was a real bloodbath. Of course, most of it was induced by the blade, but that was Bobby's last night in Atlanta, and he went out with a bang, and it was quite a match. As it said here, loser leave Georgia. Well, he was going back to Minneapolis, I think. But at any rate, he put on quite a show that night. I was very, Heenan was an excellent. As a guy representing other guys, as a manager, but most of the folks in here had never seen much of Heenan as an actual worker in the ring. And that night, he gave it his all. And I saw him coming out of the back of the Omni afterwards. He had a towel over his face, and he was trying to make his way to the car. And I just, told him, "Great job, Bobby." And he said thanks, and he was gone. But I was quite impressed with the work he did that night. He's known as the Mouth, but he put on a good show as a worker that night.
Yeah, I want to talk about him for just a minute. He still holds a grudge about the way his run here ended. He's done some interviews over the years, and I believe he wrote about it in a book. About how he was upset with Ole Anderson, because apparently he had just bought a house here. Bill Eady told me the story about how he was driving with Bobby one time, and Bobby was a little upset because of the way Ole was, this, that, and the other. And, to hear Bill put it, Bobby was just a little paranoid and a little worried about his job, and basically, you know, Bill sort of put his concerns to rest, and Bobby goes and sinks money into a house. So apparently he had planned on sticking around and not going back to Minnesota when the work suspension up there was over with. He was planning on actually staying here. And then Ole's side of the story is he thought Bobby was miserable and wanted to get out of here, so he worked the loser leaves angle. And basically that was it. Now, Bobby, I know you were in the office. Do you know anything there?
No. I just... He's one of the... I cannot knock his work, but he was one of those human beings. He was one of the few guys in his business that I just did not get along with. You know, I didn't particularly like him. Yeah, he's a good talker, but the things he did, you could teach a chimpanzee to do. And I just always thought that he thought he was far more important to the scope of things than he actually was. I thought we had much better managers here over the years. But needless to say, I don't really know the reasoning behind it. But Ole was what he was, and when you were here, you either had to deal with it or not deal with it. And I'm not real sure what happened that night. As far as the what was behind the scenes of him leaving, I just know Ole had the final word or the final say-so, and if he wanted to get rid of him, then that's what happened. But Heenan's side of the story was, and I've heard him tell it, he was told he could stay here as long as he wanted to.
Right.
That's what he says. I've never known Ole to tell anybody you can come in here and stay as long as you want to. I mean, he tried for years to get Wrestling 2 to move on and do other things. I mean, we tried a retirement angle. We tried other things, booking him out. You know, he just, so I don't know. Nobody was here forever. But
yeah.
I'm not real sure what the actual reasoning behind all of it was.
Jerry, did you ever get to work around Bobby?
I worked with him. Don't think he couldn't work. He could work. I don't know why he didn't work more, but I was around him. Where was I around him? I know I worked with him in St. Louis. That's the first time I'd ever worked with him. I was shocked. You know, I just thought he was a manager. But Bobby was very, very, very good. Very good.
He made a lot of money up there when the Bruiser had that territory up there. He made a lot of money with the Bruiser.
Yeah, he did well for himself.
Yeah, he did well up there with a Bruiser.
Well, I think he made his name for himself in the AWA while he was working as the manager for Nick Bockwinkel. I mean, they just worked so well together. Bockwinkel didn't really need a manager because he could, you know, talk as good as anybody. But him and Heenan really, you know, it was like one guy quit talking and the other guy would pick it right up. And they really work well together. Heenan came here the first time. I remember it. He must have been coming through town, going to Florida or something, and just needed to pick up a match because he came in on one Friday night and worked the second match of the night. Nobody knew him, and he lost very quickly, and he was out the door and didn't see him for a couple of years because he was, main event manager in the AWA, and then all of a sudden. He came in with a superstar, and that's the story we're talking about right now. But he was, you know, Heenan was in all the magazines.
We also talked about, Mr. Wrestling 2 beat Mr. Wrestling 2. That's the famous angle with Joe Powell under a mask. Bobby, I know you can tell that story.
Joe Powell was a guy from Macon, Georgia, and honest to God, these guys, you pass them in the hallway, if you didn't know which was which, if they didn't let you know, you couldn't tell them apart. And Joe was a product of a promoter in Macon, Georgia, he ran these little independent shows back when Ole claims there was no independent shows in Georgia. This guy ran shows all over middle and southern Georgia, and he would book people, you know, that lookalikes and whatever and so forth. But he created Joe Powell as wrestling too, and he was running him on him independent shows. And two was I think two might have been in Louisiana for a couple of months or something. But anyway,
he was there when he found out about it.
Ollie was using the guy here. Well, the deal was when John called, you know, found out what was going on, he came back here. This could have been a huge money maker. I mean, it could have been everybody could have went to the bank and done well. So when they finally booked these guys together, Jay might remember, but the deal was Joe Powell was working as two on TV, and the real two comes out of the back and just stands there. Doesn't hit the ring, just stands there. And they showed a picture, and then, you know, Joe in the ring just stops and looks at him, and he finishes the match or whatever, but they never had any contact. Well, the first time these guys were going to meet each other was this match you're talking about in the Omni.
Mm-hmm.
And we sat in the dressing room. I was back there, and Ole begged John. He said, please, do not kill this guy. We can make a lot of money. Do not, please do not kill this guy. And it was... Needless to say, it was probably the longest night of Joe Powell's life.
Well, here's what Johnny told me in an interview I did with him. I asked him, I said, it's been said that there was some legitimate heat between you and Joe Powell when you returned to Georgia at the end of 1979 and found he was doing an imposter gimmick of you. Is there any truth to that? He says, well, yeah, I didn't like the guy doing my thing. I taught him a lesson in the ring, and I think I convinced him I didn't appreciate it.
Yeah.
He says, I think he did wind up doing it again after I quit the business, but what can you do?
Yeah. Well, he worked as Mr. Wrestling number three several places, too, you know, using it as that, obviously looking the same, but working small shows. That way he couldn't be claimed as specifically saying he was a two imposter, but he used that gimmick for a while.
Yeah, it was not a... I watched about 5 minutes of it, and then I turned around and walked off because I knew that little deal had gone down the toilet.
You're right, though, Bobby. It could have made they could have done some really big business off of that.
Geez. Yeah,
shouldn't have met for the first time in the Omni like that, you know, on that kind of card. It should have been a build-up, and there should have been a lot more to it. But obviously, you know, two wanted what he wanted,
yeah,
and he got it.
Yeah. Yeah, it was... It was short-lived, and then, you know, Joe kind of disappeared from as far as working for us, and then I heard that he passed away several years ago. But these two guys were, I mean, honest to goodness, if they were walking down a hall, you had to ask who was who. You could not tell them apart. So.
Well, back to the tag title tournament that night. Of course, as I said earlier, Austin Idol and the Superstar beat the Briscoes to win the title. Some of the other teams that were in it, Bobby Jaggers and Luke Graham were in it. Ricky Fields and Buzz Sawyer teamed up. Stan Hansen, a babyface Stan Hansen, teamed up with Wahoo McDaniel, Tony Atlas and Ray Candy. Ox Baker and Killer Khan. Dusty Rhodes teamed up with Mr. Wrestling 2. Tom Shaft and Killer Carl Cox were also together.
Cox and Shaft against Rhodes and Wrestling 2, that was the opening match, I think, for the tag team tournament. How did it end up as the last four teams in there, or the last two teams?
I don't have it out in a bracket form. Let me backtrack there. Idol and Superstar beat Dusty in Wrestling 2 to get to the finals. The Briscoes beat Ricky Fields and Buzz Sawyer to get to the finals.
So it was the Briscoes in the finals?
Yeah.
Against?
They put over Austin Idol and the Superstar.
Oh, okay, because they were the local guys.
I would have loved to have seen those two team up longer. I think they only held the belts about 2 weeks, if I remember right. All right, jumping ahead to 1980. Let's see. Main event that night. Well, I don't know. The main event may have been the tag team title finals, but the NWA World Heavyweight title was on the line when Harley Race met Tony Atlas and ended in a no contest. And once again, let's see, Bob Armstrong beat Mr. Saito in another singles match on the card. The rest of the matches all had to do with the national tag team title. This was the night that the Freebirds beat Robert Fuller and Stan Frazier, who won the title. Well,
that would have been when Robert was booking.
Mm-hmm. How else would Stan Frazier have been here?
Yeah, that.
Is there a story there?
Well, I just, you know.
He really didn't fit in, did he? Oh man.
You could, you know, if you saw him once, he was kind of interesting. He certainly wasn't a haystack, you know, even though that's kind of the persona he put on a little bit, but you know, he's an old country boy. You saw him once, it was kind of funny, but you know, after that, why bother? My opinion.
You are correct.
Yeah.
Let's see. The Freebirds, to get to the finals, the Freebirds had beaten Steve Kern and Terry Taylor, and Robert Fuller and Stan Frazier had beat Ole and Gene Anderson. Kern and Taylor had also beaten Jerry Roberts and Steve-O. Freebirds had beaten the Briscoes. Ole and Gene, to get to the semifinals, had beaten Kevin Sullivan and Austin Idol. This was also the tournament where Jerry Roberts. Now, Jerry Roberts, that was Jacques Rougeau, right?
Yes.
And then Steve-O. They had actually wrestled Joey Scrable and Judy Martin that night.
Well, I was fixing to ask you, when you said they were teamed up, was that the night the two girls were in the tournament?
Yep.
There's a YouTube little segment there where Joyce Grable discusses that, which was off of the Georgia Championship Wrestling Show, where they talk about getting the opportunity to work in that tournament. And I think Steve-O actually also does a little bit in that YouTube interview where you see them talking about, you know, where Gordon's interviewing him, and he says, you know, they're not going to take it easy on the girls. It's going to be a legit, you know, match. We're going to see what's going to happen. And pretty interesting little interview.
That was a I don't remember whose idea that was, but it actually turned out to be people actually bought into it. I didn't really know how it was going to, you know, what people were going to do, but people bought into it. And Jerry Rougeau bought into it when Joyce kicked him. And then, you know, he tried to stiffen up on her, and she just put a boot where it not ought to be, and he loosened right up. But it was difficult. It was difficult on the guys because, I mean, first of all, you didn't know. You know, they worked a deal where one of them, I think the finish, the actual end of the match, was Steve-O body slammed. And I can't remember if they beat Joyce or Judy. I can't remember which one they beat. But they body slammed her. I mean, just picked her up and slammed her and covered her. And the whole premise was they could come back and say, hey, you know, we just, you know, women aren't physically as strong as men. It's, you know, we tried, we out, you know. And Steve worked with them. Steve, you know, took some arm drags and did some things and made it. It was a pretty decent match, and you could, like Jay said, you could find it on YouTube. You can see some of it, but the end of the thing was just a very simple body slam. But in order, you know, and it was a legitimate question. And, I remember Steve Olsnowski, we were standing in the hallway back in the back, and he said, "How do I grab her?" He said, "How do I scoop her up to slam her?" You know,
yeah.
And finally, it was just, hey, you scoop her like you'd scoop a guy. You just, you got to do it. And that was the deal. He just scooped her up, and he just power slammed her, boom, and covered her 1, 2, 3. But it was, we were really, everybody was worried how that was going to be bought or perceived by the fans. But the fans actually got into it.
Oh, yeah.
They got into it.
That was also that right there at Thanksgiving with the match that the Freebirds were in. The Freebirds were getting ready to leave. And they were doing some different things there where Michael Hayes was, I think him and Terry Gordy had some in-ring problems, and Buddy Roberts was kind of the odd man out. But I think right after the first of the year, they were all gone. So they were working at whatever they were doing at that point to make their exit.
Jumping ahead to 1981, once again, another National Tag Team title tournament. We'll see. The big match that night, of course, was a Texas Death Match for the National Heavyweight title. Masked Superstar beat Tommy Rich to win it. And in the tag team tournament, the finals, that's the night Bob and Brad Armstrong beat Saito and Fuji for the title. This is in 1981. Jerry, you're on this card. You and Ted had wrestled Saito and Fuji in the first round.
That was in 81?
Yep.
Just like yesterday, right, Jerry?
Yeah, I remember it. Move for move. I don't want to remember that enough.
Right after their match was Ray Candy and Buzz Sawyer going over the Russians, which was Markoff and Smirnoff. Rick Martel and Mr. Wrestling 2 over Ray Stevens and the Super Destroyer, which was, of course, Scott Irwin under a hood. Kevin Sullivan and Wayne Ferris over Steve-O and El Gran Apollo. The Armstrongs over the Sheep Herders, Boyd and Williams. And Terry Gordy and Austin Idol over Michael Hayes and Big Red ended in a no contest. Then Saito and Fuji went over Candy and Sawyer, Sullivan and Ferris over Martel and Wrestling 2, the Armstrongs over Sullivan and Ferris, and then the finals, Armstrong over Saito and Fuji.
Who did you say Ray Stevens lost to?
He was teamed with Super Destroyer, Scott Irwin. They lost to Martel and Mr. Wrestling, too.
Okay.
Michael Hayes and Big Red. That was a strange mix. Where'd that come from?
They had turned Hayes babyface.
Right.
And Big Red was just a local,
mm-hmm.
You know, he was a local guy that had a huge, he had a huge following, but not necessarily from the wrestling business. His mother was a Pentecostal preacher that had a radio show on a local cable outlet. And Big Red was on there with her all the time. And they had this huge following. It was crazy. It was like a cult thing where people followed this thing and tuned in to see it. And he was, of course, Red was, he was a big guy, but he would sell, but he wasn't very polished. Let's just put it that way. He just did his little thing and did his little dance, and he wore these long red pants. He had like a jumpsuit, and it was, you know, it was all red, and it was, but he looked like a big kid because he had freckles all over him.
Yes.
And my son, when he was about two, maybe two and a half, we're standing back in the back by the dressing room, and Red was standing there with me, and my son comes over, and you know how kids are. They're just blatantly, you know, brutally honest or dumb or stupid or whatever. He looks at Red, and he goes, you know, you're not very black for a black man. And I went, shut up. You know? But he just, he's a nice guy, but it was just.
Is he still living, Bobby?
No.
No, he died here. Not too long ago, was it? A couple of years, not, maybe.
It's been a couple of years. Do you remember what his finish was called?
Oh, geez. No, I know. It was something. I mean, I can't remember.
It was the Holy Ghost Splash.
Holy Ghost Splash. That was it. That's exactly it. Yes, sir.
And that came from his mother's show, I'm sure.
Yeah, I'm. Hey.
Red Reese.
Yeah, he actually. He passed away at the age of 51 back in 2002.
Jeez.
Yep.
He was always a happy guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Always happy, wasn't he?
Last show I worked, which I worked for Ted Allen, Big Red was on that show, and that was like 83, I guess, up in Ted's area up there, North Georgia, and a bunch of the guys that, you know, we're not working for the main office. Some of them working out of Chattanooga and things like that. And I talked to him that night, and yeah, he was very exuberant, very, very up. And that was the only long conversation that I had with him that night in the dressing room. And he just seemed like a real friendly guy.
He was. He's always happy, laughing, clapping his hands. Yeah, he was a nice guy to be around. He'd make you laugh anyhow, that's for sure.
Yep.
But Jerry, we've talked about a guy here a couple times who was back in, when I was watching this stuff happening live. I mean, he was one of my favorite guys in the ring, and I really loved the guy. Steve O, did you ever get a chance to get in the ring with him?
I don't know if I ever wrestled. I think I did wrestle Steve. He was a good hand. He got his hand messed up or something when he was here.
Yeah,
he got a staph infection.
Right. What was wrong with it?
He got a staph infection. He got a horrible, horrible staph infection. We don't know where he got it from. I remember when it all came down, I had to have every canvas in the territory washed and dry cleaned, you know, sanitized, because we were making sure it wasn't, you know, but nobody would work with him because he had this staph infection. Well, you couldn't work with him. But his hand, he swole up, his arm looked like Popeye.
But didn't it leave his hand messed up?
It possibly did, because it was a horrible staph infection. Barnett brought him into the office. He would run errands. He would go to the bank for me to, you know, I'd get the deposits ready. He would take them to the bank, or he would take tapes to the bus station. I mean, Barnett was paying him, you know, making sure he made a living. But he was coming in the office and working some because he couldn't work.
Steve was a nice guy.
Yes, he was. Very nice guy.
Yeah, we did an interview with him on Ringside Rap one night. I think Les had to miss that show. I think it was me and just me and Mike Sempervivi. But we talked to him for about an hour. Just a great guy. Told a lot of great stories around that time. Said that while he was hurt, you know, of course he was doing a lot of sitting in with Gordon Solie on commentary during that time, and with CNN just still trying to get their legs under them and being new, he told the story about how Gordon Solie was actually trying to help him catch on at CNN, you know, to be like an on-air broadcaster, anchorman, sports guy, something.
He was a good-looking guy, you know. He could have done that.
Yeah.
And if I remember correctly, he was pretty articulate.
Yep.
And, you know, came out a product of the Vern Gagne's group out there and came in as one of the high flyers. I think Vern's son either came in with him or they teamed up at one point here. But, yeah, he was, you know, I'd never thought about that, but that's something that at that time he certainly could have done, but obviously he wanted to do what he was doing.
The high flyers, you may be thinking of Jim Brunzel.
That's right, yes, you are correct. Yeah, and that was who came in with Gagne's son.
Right.
But Steve Olzanowski, I do remember him quite well. He was also one of the guys that worked out in that area, and I think went through Vern's training school.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was from Edina, Minnesota.
Right.
Suburb of Minneapolis, yep.
And he's back in that area and doing well. 1982, this would have been, I believe, your last Thanksgiving with the office, Bobby. Let's see, this night, lights out match, Butch Reed beats Bud Sawyer. Excuse me. Ivan Koloff beat Paul Orndorff, and also in a one-night tag team tournament. No title on the line this time. It was reported the purse was $30,000. We all know how that goes. The Moondogs beat Tommy Rich and Johnny Rich to win the tournament. Moondogs are managed by J.J. Dillon. And the Samoans were on their way out, but they worked on this card as well. Let's see. Going through the card, the Moondogs over Les Thornton and Billy Red Eagle, Brad Armstrong and Tito Santana over Matsuda and Yatsu, Tommy Rich and Johnny Rich over Pachinko and the Iron Sheik. The Samoans beat Kabuki and Magic Dragon. The Moondogs over Armstrong and Santana. The Riches beat the Samoans. And then the finals were the Moondogs winning over Johnny and Tommy Rich.
Which, in my opinion, would have been about a mid-card on there before 1980. Not to put down anybody there, but I think when we looked at the cards tonight, went through them after 1980 was, my opinion would be 1980 was the peak of the talent on those shows,
yeah.
And then things started going maybe downhill just a little bit after that.
Yep. And Bobby, you left shortly after that. I guess, about a month later, they had to deal with Barnett.
Yep, I left in December of that year.
You kind of left a little bit after that. Can you tell that story?
Well, it was a hostile takeover, and Barnett was leaving, going to Hong Kong. He went to Hong Kong every couple of years and for Christmas, and that's where he would get his clothes made and so forth, and he was getting ready to go. And I had just being around the office every day, I had a huge sense of something going wrong, but I didn't know what it was. And I met him at the airport the day he was leaving. He was leaving whatever morning it was. I went to the airport, and I shocked him when I walked up. And he, Mr. Bobby, what are you doing here? And I said, Jim. And I told him, I said, look, I said, I have no idea what's going on. I said, but something's happening. And I said, I got a real strong feeling you don't need to go to Hong Kong. You need to stay here. I said, you can do what you want to. I said, but I just felt like I had to come talk to you. And he said, Mr. Bobby, he said, you worry too much. He said, nothing's going on. Go to the office. I said, okay. When I got to the office that day and opened the door, it was, if I'm not mistaken, it was a Monday morning. When I got to the office and opened the door, Jim's office was open, which it was never open because it was locked most of the time. The office was open, so I went in and I set my stuff on my desk and I walked back to Jim's office and looked in the door, and Ole and Ralph Freed were back there. And Ole said, I'm glad you're here. I need to talk to you. And when I walked in, he said, just want to let you know you don't work for Jim Barnett anymore. You work for me. And he said, are you supposed to call him in Hong Kong or anything? And I went, no. I said, I'm just supposed to send him his mail, later this week. He said, well, send him the mail. He said, but I want to go through it before you send it to him. And that was the beginning of the end. I made it from
down,
that.
Bobby? How did it go down, though? I mean,
he got
how
in.
How did?
Well, I'm not real sure what the deal was, Jerry. But Barnett had 51% of the stock. He had the majority of the stock, but he got every stock that he got. Ole got every other stockholder in the company to turn on Jim. This included both Briscoes. It included Fred, which was manipulated at that time by Ralph. He did anything Ralph said. Fred had gotten, you know, Fred was up in years at that point, and Ralph was pretty much running everything. And Ralph was in Ole's back pocket, or tried to be. But he'd gotten Watts to agree to go with him. So anyway, the other 49% had agreed to go with Ole, and Ole just strong-armed him. He just he come in the office, and he just took. I mean, there wasn't no way I could argue with him. I just worked there, so I did what he wanted me to do. I took care of everything as best I could, you know, for the next couple of weeks, and I did not talk to Jim. And when Jim got back to Atlanta, Ole and Ralph was at his apartment waiting on him when he got back. And they had a conversation there that morning. And Jim called me at home that night, and he told me, he says, Ole's now running the company. He said, watch yourself. So this was probably on a Wednesday, and I walked in on a Thursday morning, and Ole's version is he fired me. My version is I walked in, laid the keys on the desk, and said I quit. My loyalty was to Barnett. He had been very good to me and my family. He had took care of me financially over the years by me doing my job and him paying me very well. And Ole knew that, and he knew where my loyalty was. It wasn't going to work. I mean, Ole fired everybody that was there eventually at some way, more than once some. But
could you have stayed?
I could have. Yeah, I didn't have to. I didn't have to leave, but I did. It was just it wasn't going to work. I was very uncomfortable. It was a very tense working for Barnett. Jim knew how to do business. He knew you had to take care of certain people to get certain things done. You didn't have to give them the gold mine, but you needed to give them a nugget every once in a while. Don't want to call no names because these people may still be actually running buildings, but there was one particular building that I know of. We would run that building. It was one of our northern towns, and we would run that building. Well, on Monday after we run that building up there, and that building always did real good. The first time we ran it, we sold it out in like 13 minutes. They put the tickets on sale, and 13 minutes later, it was sold out. This guy that was the manager up there, Barnett, knew him from some other building from years ago when he was in Lexington or in Kentucky. And every Monday after we'd run that building, I'd take $1,000 and put it in a plain white envelope. I'd fold it up in some sheets of paper, put it in an envelope, and I'd mail it to this guy's house up there. Now, what's $1,000 when you're drawing $40,000 or $45,000, whatever it was, for that little building up there? We never had a problem getting dates. We never had a problem with any of the staff at the building. We took a ring up there and left it. They put it up. They took it down. All we did was go in there and work. Immediately, Ole says, we're not doing that anymore. Well, it wasn't but about a month later, he couldn't get dates in the building. Christmas time, Barnett gave all the TV station managers where we had our tapes playing something for Christmas. The year that Urban Cowboy was the big movie, whatever year that was, every station manager got... What year was it?
1980.
Mm-hmm. Every station manager that had a TV station that we had our tape airing, they got a Stetson hat for Christmas. A lot of money invested in hats that year. But we never had a problem with our time slots. You know, you took care of people. And when God love him, me and Ole get along great. He is what he is, and that's the way he did business. But he stopped all that. He didn't do that. And all of a sudden, he couldn't get dates. He couldn't get TV shows. It was not very hard for Vince to come in and steal his dates and steal his shows and eventually take his business. So it was just a week after I was gone, almost a week to the day, I get a phone call one morning, and it's Ole, and he wants me to come to the office. And I said, why? And he said, well, we got some things here we don't understand. He said, we got some some things here that looked like people had been paid or this was happened or that's happened, you know, and said, we don't understand. Why don't you come here and explain all this to us? And my question was, how much does it pay? And he went, well, it's not going to pay anything. I said, well, I'm not coming. I said, a lot of times it's not necessarily who you know. I said, it's what you know. And I said, I've got the knowledge of all that stuff. But I said, why should I give it to you for nothing? And, of course, he got bent out of shape over that and said a few things. And I said, but before I hang up on you, I said, I want to thank you because in the week since I left the office, it had been me and Ronnie West for probably the last 5-6 years. Freddie Miller was gone. Scrappy's dad, Charlie, was driving a ring truck. He'd come in, do a few errands here and there. But it was basically me and Ronnie running the office every day. And a week after I was gone, they had 5 people working in the office. Louise Cochran was there, or Louise Bennett at the time was there. They'd brought Leo Garibaldi in. I think that's one of the short stretches where he had fired Ronnie. You know, he fired Ronnie and hired him back, fired him back. Anyway, he had 5 people in there running, working in the office. I told him, I said, I just want to thank you. And he said, for what? I said, you give me the greatest compliment I've ever been given. And he said, what are you talking about? And I says, you got 5 people in there doing what me and Ronnie West have done for the last 5 years. I said, if 2 can do what 5 does, I said, don't make a lot of sense to pay 5 when you could pay 2, does it? And that was the last time I talked to him until I saw him in Mobile, Alabama at a reunion probably 10 years ago. So it was a very, very, very tense, trying time there for a while.
Well, at the time of his takeover there for Barnett, Bobby, were things financially kind of going down the hill?
You know, at the time, when I left there, it was financially sound. You know, Ole made it out to be that, you know, that the office was in debt and there was no money there and blah, 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 blah. The day that I left, I left on Thursday morning. The Wednesday before I left, Ole had had me balance a checkbook. And there was over $100,000 in the bank when I left. That was in the bank. You know, the Northern Tours were making a lot of money. It was just, you know, Ole's philosophy about people working in the office, you were either a stooge or you were a thief. There was no in-between. It didn't matter what you did, who you did, how you did, you know, just not going to happen.
And his philosophy pretty much was my way or the highway, you know.
That was it. I mean, it was, you know, and, you know, you just, you know, I don't know. I'm not real sure what he did. It was a strange time, and he thought, I'm sure he thought he was doing the right thing. I'm sure he thought he knew better than everybody else. You know, say what you will about Barnett. Barnett was a smart businessman, and he knew how to do business, and he knew how to take care of people, and that's just a fact. You got to spend a little to make it and to make a little, and he thought you just, because it was a wrestling business and because this is how we do business and this is who we are, that it's going to work this way. Well, it didn't take him very long to figure out it didn't work that way, and next thing you know, Crockett's running the Atlanta TV, and then not too long after that, New York's running the Atlanta TV. So,
well, all I can tell you is when it ended, him or Ralph never worked again.
That's exactly right.
I'm telling you what I know.
Yeah. Well, there ain't no telling how much they got.
I'm just telling.
Well, I just, here again, I have no personal animosity against Ralph Freed at all. Me and Ralph always got along. It was a business relationship. We're not friends. We're acquaintances. Is what it was, and still is, I guess. I mean, I've seen Ralph came to the reunion one year, and me and Ralph got along fine. I got no problem. But me personally knowing as good as Jim Barnett was to Ralph Freed financially, to do what he did, I had a real problem with it. And I think that's another reason I couldn't stay there. Because, I mean, you just, it kept going through my head, if they do this to him, it's just going to be a while before they do it to me or they do it to somebody else. And, you know, it just, I don't know. It was my time to go, and I look back at it now. I had a ball. I'd do it all over again. I'd hit the road tomorrow if I was physically able, and it was like it used to be. But I learned to be very happy and very content working my job. I've been there 28 years, and I enjoy coming home at night and you know, being at home. So
can't beat it, can you?
It worked out.
But, you know, in any kind of business, when you start to see folks you've been working with and then they're not there for whatever reason, then it's natural to start to decide, well, am I not going to be here? You know, and it can be the kick in the pants you need to look for something else.
Well,
did you ever consider going to work for another office?
Who, me?
Yeah.
No.
Stay in the business?
Renesto was booking Nashville. And he was also booking some in Detroit sometime around that time. I can't remember exactly. And he may have been helping somebody else or something. And he tried to get me to go somewhere. I talked to him, and he said, well, why don't you come up here? And I forget where it was, and I knew guys were starving to death. And I said, well, you know, I love you, brother, but I said, I can starve to death sitting here at home as well as I can starve to death up there. So, I don't think, I mean, I never seriously considered. Maybe I could have, probably could have, but It was just time. I had gotten to the point, working in the office, I had gotten to the point where I was tired of babysitting grown folks. If you had 31 pieces of talent like Jerry Oates and Ted Oates, where you asked them to go somewhere and you knew they were going to show up, you knew they were going to be sober, you knew they weren't going to be high as a kite, you knew if you asked them to do this particular thing, this is what we're trying to do, and you laid out a plan for them, and they would do their job, you know. But that wasn't the case. We had guys
that were... I appreciate that, Bobby.
Well, I mean, it's just the truth, Jerry, and we had guys... We had guys that were, they one in particular guy, he's dead now, so I'll say his name. Buzz Sawyer would call the office at 8 o'clock on Monday morning. I wouldn't have time to get the door open, and he would be screaming, can I come pick my check up? All because he owed his pusher or his drug dealer, or he needed more, or he didn't have any. I mean, you know, I mean, these guys were, Tony Atlas, we've talked about this. He kicked the hinges off the door.
And they pushed them, Bobby. They pushed them.
Yeah. I mean, I don't understand. You know, Ole said he didn't understand. He said, I didn't know he was high on drugs. He must have been blind. But it was just, you know, these guys, you know, the straw that broke the camel's back for me, I think this is really what just drove me over the edge. I got a phone call at 2 o'clock in the morning from the rental car company where we rented the cars out of Columbus, Ohio for those tours. And the lady on the phone tells me, she says, sir, we're not going to be able to rent you cars anymore after you turn these in. And I said, may I ask you why? I said, we've been paying you, is the money a problem? She goes, oh, no. She said, tonight, two of your wrestlers tried to drive one of our Lincoln Town cars down the railroad tracks. And she said they busted the tie rod ends off. And she said they were having to kick the tires back straight on the car so it would roll forward. Now, that was just the end of it for me. I mean, we were running a daycare center for adults. These guys were making more money than they had ever made in their life. We paid for their rental cars. We gave them a per diem every day to eat and their hotel and to help with their hotels. We flew them up there. We paid their trans up there, their trans back. All they had to do was go up there and work and come home and take their check and put it in the bank.
She's a professional wrestler.
and you know, be, you know, just have some sense of propriety about yourself to act like you were somebody. I mean,
when
I,
they would get up there, they didn't even know their own names, Bobby.
Oh, I know. And you know the thing, maybe I'm wrong. I know I'm not. I know you were the same way. I was so proud to be in this business. I would never, ever, ever have thought of going to the matches in a pair of flip flops and a pair of shorts.
Bobby,
I would
that's
never
real sin.
I would never. I'll be honest. I was too afraid of my mama to get involved with something that made me lose my credibility as far as being a decent human being. I didn't, you know. I mean, I don't know. I didn't understand them. But that was part of me. And I told the day, you know, I've said this. I said it to Barnett after I left there. I said it was like running a daycare center for adults.
But whose fault was it, Bobby?
Well, whoever was in charge.
Thank you for putting up with it. If you don't have any pride in yourself, you can't have any pride of what you do. And there's no saying you can't buy class. Either you got it or you don't. And these guys had no class.
No.
And that's one reason I got off the road as young as I did, which probably I shouldn't have, but I did.
Well, I was very careful. One of my things, I was very careful about who I rode with. I was not going to jail for somebody else's stupidity. Now, I'm not going to sit here and tell you that there's probably times I should not have gone to jail for being involved, not drugs or anything like that, but just, you know, doing stupid stuff, you know, like, and we were prone to entertain ourselves in different ways, but I mean, there's just people I wouldn't ride with, and because I knew they were going to do something stupid, and I think that's why I spent so much time with John Walker. I spent so much time driving that ring truck by myself or with Randy or whoever they had helping me at the time. I made the mistake of riding with Billy Spears one time, and we were running 100 mile an hour in a left-hand lane, and he bumped this old woman because she wouldn't move out of the way, and I thought, Lord, please let me get home.
I worked with somebody that was doing the booking here in Georgia. He was the booker.
Uh-huh.
I worked with him in Athens, Georgia. He was so smoked up, he didn't even know what town we were in, and I had to work with him.
Jeez.
Well, I know all of you know that there's guys that you work with that were on top that made a ton of money and don't have a cent in their pocket today because of exactly that's what they did.
Yeah.
And you had to go in the ring and work with these guys.
They had they thought they had a reputation to live up to. And, another thing I think that was a problem during that time is, in the 40s and the early 50s, you had national television. Wrestlers at that time were seen on big-time television as it existed. But in the 60s and the 70s and the early 80s, when you got outside of the actual wrestling media, wrestlers to a great extent were put down by the newspapers, you know. It was all fake. I think maybe some of the guys had to live with that, and it was hard when they were trying to keep their personality out there and build themselves up, and it maybe made them do things that they wouldn't have done otherwise. But when you get right down to it, it's like Bobby said, you got to have pride in yourself. Doesn't matter whether you're working for $10 an hour or $5,000 an hour. If you don't have pride in yourself, eventually you're going to get your legs cut off.
Yep. Well, I just I had a wonderful run. I did my best to represent myself and the business I was in as best I could, and it killed me to watch these guys do this, and I guess it's jealousy. These guys were making a whole lot more money than I was, and yet they seemed to not care. You know, they live
care.
Like it was never going to end, and just, I don't know.
Live for the moment.
It was sad.
Well, Bobby,
but you still got
you
guys
left,
trying to make these shows every weekend because they don't know nothing else to do.
Well, Bobby, after you left, it was the year that pretty much everything really started to decline, and I attribute that to the loss of you. Of course, that was tongue-in-cheek. 1983 was a pretty rough year. The really bad angle of buying the national title, the failed experiment of the Bill Dundee booked GCW group in the summer, being done in Chattanooga, with Jarrett sending talent down and booking it with some of Ole's B-level talent, doing the house shows down here so they could focus more on the Northern Tour with the big names. Just a really, really, really rough year. Even looking at this Thanksgiving card, Zbyszko and Killer Brooks are gone by the time Thanksgiving rolls around. There's some good names on this card in the tag team tournament. The bad thing is most of the people in the tournament weren't even from here. That had been done in the past, but for the most part, this tournament's just about made up of nothing but that. They were not most, for the most part, I would say all but a couple of them were not regulars at all. The top matches were about the only ones. The top three matches were the only ones that were really staffed with regular roster. Just going over the card real quick, Tommy Rich and Buzz Sawyer, this was about a month after their blow-off, the last battle of Atlanta. They teamed up to beat the Road Warriors with Paul Ellering in the main event. Jake Roberts beat Mr. Wrestling 2. Ted DiBiase beat Brett Sawyer. There was a ladies' match with Debbie Combs going over Donna Day. The tag team tournament was not for a title again this year. It was a supposed purse of $50,000. The finals, it was Butch Reed and Pez Watley beating Randy Savage and Magnum TA in the finals. And just looking back through some of the names, some of the teams that were thrown together for this thing, Jim Neidhart and King Kong Bundy, Tommy Rogers and Joe Lightfoot, Randy Rose and Jimmy Randolph. Randolph, I don't remember him being anything other than TV enhancement talent. The Bruise Brothers, Troy Graham and Porkchop Cash. The Russians, Nikolai Volkov, Christina Kirchenko. Ron Garvin teamed with Jim Duggan. Bob Brown teamed with Chick Donovan. There was a team called the Mad Mongolians who basically nobody seems to remember who they were. It wasn't Guido and what was his name?
Pepper.
Gene Lewis had teamed with Guido.
Right.
I want to say 82 or so, and they were in here. But these were totally different guys. I have no idea who they were. But that was to me the first really bad Thanksgiving card, and sadly the last under Georgia Championship Wrestling, basically, before the big buyout. Now, Bobby, you had said earlier that pretty much all these Thanksgiving cards, just based on the nature of the event, you could pretty much count on a sellout, and I guess they pretty much all were, right? And then all of a sudden, 83 is the first year I've got attendance numbers, and it was around 12,000 was what was reported.
Well, look at the list of talent you got there.
Yeah.
And, I mean, you know.
I mean, there's some big names all throughout that tournament.
I understand. But, you know, that's just like you can put a whole list of big names together, but if there's not any personal issues in this, you know, you got to have somebody there that somebody wants to see somebody killed.
Yeah, that's clearly thrown together.
Yeah, I mean, it was just, I think the booking was, I don't know. Is that when Jake Roberts had come in and started helping?
He didn't start booking until February of 84, so that was a little later on.
Oh, okay.
I think another thing that was happening there, if you go back to 70, you know, to 75 through 79, the city auditorium was still having wrestling on Friday nights. So when you would go to the Omni then, it was a big deal, you know, and there started to be more Omni cards, but you'd have the city auditorium 3 weeks out of the once the Omni started having wrestling, 3 weeks out of the month, and you'd go to the Omni once, and folks thought, you know, you're gonna see a lot bigger matches. But once the auditorium was gone after the end of 79, then the Omni got diluted a little bit because that was where you went for wrestling, and so it lost. I think it lost a little bit of its charm, and plus the fact that the talent started dropping off. So then the number of fans started dropping off. But 70, 78, 79, 80, they were legit sellouts.
When did Pedicino start running all his shows on TV?
That was after 80. That was 82, I think, probably 82, 83, somewhere around in there.
I'm thinking it was somewhere around late 83, early 84.
Right.
Well, there again, too, you know, when he started doing that nonsense, and then, you know, here again, I'm just an observer at this point.
Right.
But here again, if you got, he was running 8, 7, 8 hours of wrestling on Saturday nights.
At its peak.
Yes. If you got 8 hours of wrestling on TV, why do I need to buy a ticket to go watch it?
And not only that, but you know, the business was still kind of closed off a little bit at that point. When you start seeing 8 hours of wrestling, you start to learn pretty much everything that's going on everywhere, because you're seeing pretty much all the major booking offices there.
Yes, sir. And you see a guy here that's just your big baby face here, and you see him somewhere else, and he's a top heel there. And, I mean, there again, that was another Barnett thing. Barnett, you know, everybody in the country wanted to put a tape on here in Atlanta. I mean, they were trying their best to get on some of these cable stations around Atlanta. And to get on, you know, they were hoping to somehow, you know, wiggle into a spot on 17. But, you know, there again, Barnett kept them out. That was another thing he did. He blocked them. He kept those tapes from getting into the wrong hands here, and because that was one of his philosophies. Hey, if they can watch it for free, they're not going to buy a ticket.
Right. 36 was hungry, so that's where they
went.
Oh,
yeah.
Well, I got to tell you, I loved it.
I know you did. I remember meeting Pedicino. We went over there. Me and Freddie went over there for something. And I don't remember even what it was, but we had to go over there, and maybe we were editing a tape or doing something. And we went to 36, and that was my first and only meeting with Pedicino.
I can't even imagine Freddie Miller and Joe Pedicino in the same room at the same time.
Well, it was, I Pedicino was trying to act like he was hip to all that was going on, and I just kayfabed him. I just wouldn't, you know, bite into it. And, you know, I think I offended him, you know, because he thought he was smarter than what he was. But it was just a, I don't know. That was
I knew, and, you know, Joe's still around. I knew Joe Pedicino from the radio days, from way before he was ever involved in wrestling.
Right.
And you know, he wouldn't talk to me. I'll just flat out say it. He wouldn't talk to me later on, after he started getting in wrestling, because he knew that I knew when he didn't know anything about the business.
Right.
And you know, so he just wouldn't talk to me anymore. And that's, you know, as far as I'm concerned, that was okay if he didn't want to, but that was his loss.
Yeah.
I knew Joe from way back. Way before he was involved in wrestling.
The one thing I will say for it, my one and only paycheck I ever got from Vince's office was for recording that mess one Saturday night and mailing it up there. Jim called me, and he said, Jim was working, he was working as a controller for Vince. And he called me, and he goes, what's that guy doing down there? And I told him, how about recording it for me? He said, send me 4 hours worth of it. And I recorded 4 hours and sent him a tape. And, I just did it because Jim asked me to. And about a week later, man, I went to my mailbox and had a nice little paycheck from Titan Sports. And I thought, Jim, I hope you need this more often.
And that's right. You could just keep those tapes a coming, couldn't you?
Speaking of Vince, the next Thanksgiving, the WWF ran a Thanksgiving card in Atlanta, apparently trying to keep the tradition going, but it didn't last. That would be the last time they would do that.
You got any attendance figures for that?
No, I don't. The main event was Nikolai Volkoff versus Sergeant Slaughter. That ended in a no contest. Paul Orndorff won a battle royal with an alleged purse of $10,000. Let's see. Jack and Jerry Briscoe beat Terry Gibbs in the spoiler. Mr. Wrestling 2 over Brutus Beefcake by disqualification. Mike Rotundo beat Johnny Valiant. Bret Hart and Les Thornton went to a draw. Junkyard Dog over Rene Goulet, the Iron Sheik over Rick McGraw, and Paul Orndorff beat Abe Jacobs in the opener. Some of the names from the Battle Royal were some that appeared in the earlier matches I just mentioned, some not. Let's see, had Bill Mascaris, Rick McGraw, Jerry Briscoe, Jack Briscoe, Mr. Wrestling 2, Barry Windham, Blackjack Mulligan, Jay Strongbow, Junkyard Dog, Kamala, Paul Orndorff won it, Rene Goulet, the spoiler, the Iron Sheik, Brutus Beefcake, Johnny Valiant, Terry Gibbs, and David Sammartino. And then, let's see, 1980, we didn't post these today, 1985, there was a card promoted by Jim Crockett Promotions, part of the Starcade. They also did that in 86, and then by 87, they were in Chicago, and there were no more Thanksgiving cards. So, that was it.
Well,
nice run, though.
It was fun while it lasted.
Yep, that's where folks went on Thanksgiving night. If they were a wrestling fan, even just, not even a hardcore, but just somebody that liked to do it occasionally because they knew they were going to see the big show at the Omni on Thanksgiving night, and they would be there.
Jerry mentioned earlier about running Columbus on Thanksgiving. They used to draw good houses on Thanksgiving afternoon down there, didn't they, Jerry?
Sure did, Bobby. It'd be full.
Yeah.
It'd be full.
I would imagine a lot of those folks, if they were down there, you know, if they were the regulars, they would go down there and then come to Atlanta.
They did. They did,
yeah.
Jerry.
I can remember, and I can't remember if it was Thanksgiving or a Christmas show. Geigel booked a Christmas show. Geigel booked an afternoon show in Kansas City. I think he started out there about 3 o'clock, which is 4 o'clock Atlanta time. And his matches ended, you know, at 6, a little after 6 out there, which is a little after 7 here. And we got an 8:30 start time. Well, he booked a tag team tournament one Christmas, and he had Dusty, and he had the Briscoes, and he had a couple other people out there. I can't remember. There was 4 or 5 people that we normally had here. So we're panicking. They're running around screaming in the office, and they're trying, what are we going to do? We can't get these guys. They can't get here in time. No commercial. I can remember sitting up the deal with a Learjet service at Charlie Brown Airport. We chartered a Learjet. And it's not like calling a cab and saying, I want you to pick them up in Kansas City and bring them here. We had to pay for that Learjet to fly from Atlanta to Kansas City, pick those guys up, and then fly them back here. And they got back here, I can remember, it was about 9 or 9:30. And we sent Scrap's dad, Charlie McGowan, we sent Charlie, and we sent Randy out there in 2 separate vehicles because we had some baby faces and heels. And we picked them up. I think Harley might have been one of them. And we picked them up and brought them back to the Omni to work our show that night. I can't remember this. I don't even remember what year it was, but I think it was almost $5,000.
That's what I was going to ask, if you could remember how much it cost to.
It was about $5,000 to get that Learjet to go out there and bring them back. But there again, you know, that seems extravagant, but what's $5,000 when you're drawing $100,000?
Right.
You know, you mark it off to expense, and this is here again. This is something that you know, you hear all these people talk about Barnett and about his payoffs, and Barnett never and I'm telling you, this is the gospel truth. If you drew whatever you drew, the talent got 30% of the net. That was the whatever the gross house was. You took the sales tax off of it, and the talent got 30% of that. And you know, that extra $5,000 that came off the office's end, it did not come off the talent end.
That's the way to do business.
Well, he was. I've heard a lot of guys talk about there was a lot of great payoff guys in the business. I just, the only person I ever did it for was for Jim, and he taught me his system, and I would sometimes do it, and then he would look it over, and he would sometimes change it, and other times he'd say, okay, you did good, but that's the way he did business. And you know, it seems that people, you know, I've had people say, well, that's not enough money for the talent. You know, you got to remember, if you drew $100,000, $25,000 or $30,000 of that money goes to the Omni.
Mm-hmm.
Because they worked on, they got 18%. That was the rent. And then you had to pay all the expenses after you paid the rent. That didn't include ushers, security, whatever else. They had a whole list of stuff you had to pay for. So, you know, you almost a third of your money went to just the building. And then you had the other 30% went to the office, but all your expenses came out of that, all your TVs, all your transportation, all of that came out. So they didn't make as much as everybody thought they made, but it was like I say, it was a fun time. It was a fun time.
Jerry?
Well, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it. Just like everybody else. Everybody,
yeah.
You know, you got your, you know, everybody's got their complaints and gripes about it, but I enjoyed what I did. I really did. And I think most all guys that would be honest with themselves, they would do it again.
Yep, without
a doubt. As we knew it, you know. Territories were nice, you know. If you didn't like that territory, you could leave and go to another one, you know. But it was a great experience. Met a lot of great people, met a lot of sorry people. Just like in anything else.
There's a lot of similarities in the music business with the wrestling business, I can tell you that.
Oh, yeah.
All kinds.
And the radio business, too.
Yeah, Jay knows about that. As a matter of fact, Jay, I was thinking about you today. It's kind of a tradition in our house to watch the Turkey's Way episode of WKRP. I was thinking about you.
Dr. Johnny Fever and, I was watching KRP the other night, and I thought about the Thanksgiving episode. I forget, MeTV was saying they were going to run it three times, I think. But, you know, Dr. Johnny Fever, Harold Hessman character, was, if you believe the story, he was, you know, and I do, because I knew Skinny Bobby Harper fairly well, both in the 60s and later on, that his character was copied after Skinny Bobby Harper. And WKRP basically was modeled after WQXIAM here in Atlanta. And, of course, the throwing the turkeys out of the back end of the helicopter, not knowing that they couldn't fly, was something that actually happened in Atlanta. It wasn't just a myth or, you know, an old wives' tale. It was something that it wasn't made up. It happened.
and that today is still 30 minutes of the best television ever.
You're not kidding. And, you know, I loved it for a lot of reasons. Just simply, I mean, it was the Big Bang Theory of its time, you know, that show. But for me, it was a little more because it was about the business that I was in. And like I said, it followed kind of the careers in a way of some of the people that I knew. But, I mean, you could have absolutely nothing to do with radio or anything of that nature and that was still a great show. It had a fantastic cast, and you can look at one of those shows today, just like you say, Rich, and it's, you know, it's just, it's not dated in that sense, the comedy.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It stands up. Well, guys, Jay, I want to thank you for joining us. It's been fun, and I hope everybody did have a great Thanksgiving. And if you guys got anything else, any last thoughts here before we wrap it up?
Go ahead. Well, just let me real quickly say I didn't mean to take up anybody else's time if they were trying to call in, but when I saw what was going on here tonight, then I said, Thanksgiving, yeah, let me throw in my 2 cents worth, and I think maybe I got a little bit more than that, but it was certainly a pleasure to talk with you gentlemen tonight about something that I remember quite well, Thanksgiving at the Omni.
Absolute blast, Jay.
Thanks, Jay. We appreciate it. I just want to say, you know, I don't tell you guys enough how much I appreciate you. I enjoy this. When Rich first asked me to do this several years ago, I came up with all sorts of reasons I couldn't do it and didn't want to do it, and he just kept on, and he probably is sad he did now, but this has become my favorite. I mean, I look forward to this, and I just don't tell you guys enough how much I do enjoy this. This is one of the highlights of my week. And another highlight I had this week, and this is a message for Jerry, I got a phone call from Honolulu about 11 o'clock Tuesday night, and Mr. Walker said, make sure I tell you hello and hope you have a wonderful Thanksgiving.
I appreciate that, Bobby.
He's doing well, and he said he just wanted to check in, let everybody know he's doing good, and he misses everybody, and hopes to see us sometime in the spring.
That sounds good, Bobby.
Hey, Bobby, just one more thing I wanted to get out there. I'd forgotten to ask this as we were having that conversation earlier, but I wanted to ask you, if when Jim Barnett ended up working for Vince, if he'd have called you up and said, hey, come on up to Connecticut, what would you have said?
That's a good question.
It'd have been hard not to go. It would have been hard not to go. I don't know how I would have fit in that corporate environment up there, but it would have been hard not to go. Working for him, knowing what he expected, I would have been all right. I'd have been comfortable with that. But chances are, I would have probably went to Connecticut just to see what it was all about.
Absolutely. All right, guys. Well, it's been a blast, and I'm glad we went through with doing the Thanksgiving show, and definitely want to get back next week and do that referee show we talked about.
Sounds good.
I'm ready to do it.
And Jay, if you'd like to join us, feel free, man.
Thank you very much, Rich.
Love to have you. All right,
okay.
Guys. It's been great. We'll talk to you next week. And for our listeners that tuned in tonight, thanks for sharing part of your Thanksgiving with us. And we'd like for you to tune in next week as well. See you here.
Sounds good.
Bye-bye.
Good night, guys.
Good night.
We thank you for listening to this broadcast, a production brought to you by the GWH Radio Network. Stay tuned to GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com for the latest information on upcoming events and more. As always, we thank you for your continued support.